This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Before America's Congress, President Truman makes the most momentous speech since the death of Franklin Roosevelt. He declares political war on Soviet Russia.
After the Second World War, the United States emerged as a superpower. And our rivalry with the Soviet Union, culminating in a terrifying, prolonged nuclear arms race, came to dominate the globe.
If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world.
And yet these decades after the war were the start of a real flowering of American culture, serious and popular.
The subject for tonight's discussion, is there a beat generation?
Pop art, op art, underground movies, call it what you will, these two are the leaders, Edie Sedgwick and Andy Warhol.
This means, in the case of an American Negro, born in that glittering republic, and in the moment you are born, since you don't know any better, every stick and stone and every face is white, and since you have not yet seen a mirror, you suppose that you are too.
In literature, painting, music, all the arts, America had finally come out of the shadow of Europe and had all the world's attention. This period and all its complicated glory is the subject of a new book by Louis Menand. Its title is The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War. Louis Menand, or Luke as he's known to almost everyone, is a staff writer for The New Yorker, a professor at Harvard, and a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He writes in The Free World that the post-war era was a time when ideas mattered, painting mattered, movies mattered, poetry mattered. I have to begin by asking you, Luke, what did you set out to do here?
You know, when you write histories of periods like that, you're trying to bring a vanished world to life. You're trying to help readers go through a kind of looking glass into a world that's familiar and strange at the same time, and to give people a feeling of what it was like to paint a painting or write an article about painting or write a poem in those years. And the years that I picked to write about, 1945, 1965, I think are period where those questions are really interesting because we sort of get what they were doing, but we also feel a little distant from it. So it's a great opportunity to try to put all the pieces together and to bring it to life.
Well, let's begin with the phrase, the free world, and the concept of freedom, which in many ways this book is about. Was freedom not a theme? Was freedom not part of Americanness in, say, the 20s or certainly before the end of the Second World War?
Why of course that? It was, yeah. It's the Declaration of Independence,
right?
Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, that's sort of the American ideology, is a kind of liberationist ideology. But I think what happens in this period is that it becomes international, because you have to think about the period after 1945 as being shaped by three really great events. One was the Russian Revolution, the second was the rise of Hitler, and the third was the Great Depression. And those things combined made a lot of people feel, not unrealistically, that totalitarianism was where the world is headed, That's what George Orwell's 1984 is about. It's a kind of, this is what the future is going to look like for everybody, everywhere. A lot of people took that very seriously. So the idea that freedom is what gets lost in that new world is what motivated them to take seriously art and ideas. And that's what's most striking about the period, is how incredibly important people thought it was about the way you did a painting or the way you wrote a poem.
So let's talk about some of the artists in your book. You go very deeply into their art and their lives, but you're also engaged in a work of cultural history. You're looking at the social forces that play on the artist, that shape his or her perspective. So does looking at it that way undermine our cherished notion about individual artistic genius?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I've thought a lot about it. It's a mystery. You know, there's a certain set of circumstances that arise because of social change, sometimes technological change, that create conditions for the possibility of a certain kind of art or a certain kind of music. And then somebody has to come along and fulfill those possibilities. And there's this kind of, I would say, almost magical intersection between what an individual has that they can do and what the moment calls for. So Jackson Pollock, who struggled for years and years and years, suddenly in 1947, he started throwing paint on the canvas. He solves a huge problem that existed in Western art for 15 years.
Well, what was the problem, and what does it mean to solve it?
So the problem is having to do with what should be the subject matter of painting, whether the subject matter should be abstract or representational. And so part of what Pollock did was to create a form of abstraction that was pure abstraction.
I don't work from drawings or color sketches. My painting is direct.
He did that by taking the canvas off the easel.
I usually paint on the floor.
Where the canvas is essentially a window onto the landscape or the person that you're painting, and put it on the floor.
Having the canvas on the floor, I feel nearer, more of a part of the painting.
He made it into this material object that he then threw paint on.
This way I can walk around it, work from all four sides, and be in the painting.
And that was a radical gesture. The second thing he did, which turned out to be more important for the history of American art than the drip paintings themselves, was that he danced around the studio as he threw paint on the canvas. And those dances were captured by photographers, by Hans Namuth and Arnold Newman, and then in a film by Hans Namuth, who had a film of Pollock painting. And that was an enormous influence on happenings and performance art and conceptual art in the 1960s, stuff that looks very different from abstract expressionism, but actually took Pollock as a hero for opening up what counted as art beyond just what was on the canvas. Now suddenly the whole act of making a painting was itself a work of art. So a dominant impulse on the American side, in the free world side, in the Cold War, is to provide a contrast with what's going on in the Soviet Union. So Soviet art is famously representational. The term for it is socialist realism, and the idea is that the artist has to represent the history of the class struggle. And that was a very easy target for Western artists to bounce off of. So what the United States promoted, to the extent there was government support for promoting American art, which there was in the 50s, they promoted not a particular style of art, like abstract expressionism. They promoted the idea of diversity of artistic styles. So what they were saying to the rest of the world was, in the U.S., we don't have an official aesthetic, unlike the Soviets. You can paint anything you want. You can paint a soup can. You know, you can throw paint on a canvas. You can paint an American flag. It's cool with us because we're the free world. Don't you wish you were like us?
So what happens in this book is so many things start to happen with an incredible speed. Andy Warhol paints a soup can. Jasper Johns paints an American flag. Allen Ginsberg tries to crack up the language. Rock and roll comes along and is a revolution in music. What is happening that unites the Beatles, Bob Dylan, and the rest of rock and roll to Andy Warhol, to what's the currents in literary criticism, all these things that you're trying to both marry and be suggestive about in a political and cultural way?
Yeah, there was a really obsessive interest in the nature of art and thought, and that people were very invested in how the paradigms worked for literary studies, for example, literary criticism, or for fine art, or for movies. And that the period is fascinating because it has this sense of a deep intellectual investment in these areas. And then it comes to an end around 1965 with the war in Vietnam, and suddenly it all cracks up. The whole project in the Cold War, which was the project of keeping communism in its box while it withered away under its own inefficiencies, is that it led the United States to intervene covertly and overtly in other countries' politics in ways that were terrible for the people who lived there, like in Indonesia and South Vietnam, but very bad for the reputation of the United States as well. So at the end of the period, the United States comes out as an imperialist power, which is exactly what we didn't want to do in 1945. But what you get at the end of this period is a much more open view of cultural possibilities. People are much more interested in thinking about movies and popular culture and popular music and so forth than they were in 1945. That's an opening up of the American experience. That's really important, and that's what we've inherited from this time.
Luke, concentrating on that period must influence the way you think of the period that we're in now. How do you make sense of the maelstrom of what's happening now in the middle of a pandemic, racial upheaval, disharmony in the political world? Is it possible to make sense of things while you're living it, or does it require the, I don't know, 40, at least a generation period of time distance where you can start making sense of things?
To me, it requires time. I mean, I've always been interested in this period, 50s and 60s, American history. But I didn't feel I could write about it until it was sufficiently dead, because it's hard to get disinterested enough. You have to be disinterested to a certain extent. I mean, I obviously care about it, but I feel I had some distance from it. It's very hard to write about. Like right now, obviously the big story for the last 20 years has been the digital revolution. It's just transformed everything. But who understands it? You know, it's just we're in the fishbowl still. So it does take, I'm not discouraging people from commenting on it because everybody does, including me, but we're not really going to understand it for a while. It takes a while for that things to start to make sense.
The book is The Free World. I cannot recommend it highly enough. My colleague, Luke Menin, thanks so much.
Thank you, David. This has been fun.
Luke Menin's book, The Free World, Art and Thought in the Cold War, is out now. Luke is a staff writer and a professor at Harvard University.